convictions in his bench trial in Chesterfield Circuit Court and his convictions of forcible sodomy and animate object penetration.
Mr. Cooley, if you could, we've obviously read the entire background of the case, and if you could, and also, Mr. Anderson, be as delicate as you can with regard to the recitation of the facts, it would be most appropriate.
Judge, I will certainly try to do that. I'm certainly not using the name, but all of this was public record, so I'll do my best to do that. We've raised three issues. The first two relate to sufficiency evidence of the convictions. The third one relates to a due process violation that arose after a representation by the Commonwealth post or prior to trial. I would urge this court that this case has to be viewed with an awareness that the defendant in this case, Mr. Harrison, has an autism spectrum disorder known as Asperger's syndrome. And persons with that syndrome find it difficult, if not impossible, to read body language and facial expressions. They miss social cues. They have a strong desire to please. They're easily manipulated. They are easily tricked. And while they are high-functioning in terms of intelligence, it is a disability, and in this case has to be viewed in that light. It's especially important in this case because the complainant was aware of the affectations of Mr. Harrison. They had dated
him. Even in that context, Mr. Cooley, let me ask you this. It appears from the record, looking at this matter, that the whole case came down to a credibility determination. In other words, you know, whether or not your client in this situation understood the concept of no means no, and I think I counted maybe four or five times, and there was some question as to what that really meant. We can set that aside. But it seems that the fact finder in the case took great pains to sort of evaluate everything that was going on and made a factual determination, essentially crediting the victim in this case as opposed to your client. What would be your response?
My response to that would be that, as we've indicated, the trier of fact did not sufficiently weigh the Asperger's aspect of this and her knowledge of the way he reacts or perceives or misperceives things. And in addition to that, when in the course of this, the court ultimately, in making its decision, determined, well, he acknowledged, he being Mr. Harrison, that he had not been fully candid with her about certain things, and therefore his credibility was affected by that. Subsequent to the trial, we discovered that a primary consideration of the court, which had been she denied that during the interlude that they had together, that she had shown him these photographs of her, these semi-nude photographs of her, which she knew and acknowledged that he had asked her not to show him anymore because it was a tease, a turn on to him. She denied at trial that she had done that. We come back for sentencing, and the pre-sentence report contains the police report in which she had acknowledged to the original interviewing detective that she had, in fact, done that. So part of the basis of the credibility determination was kind of undercut by what came out at the sentencing hearing.
Assuming that the idea that there was a misinterpretation of body English and communication and the like, how do you deal with the fact that after the incident, I'm going to call it an incident, occurred, your client said some things and did some things which suggest that he understood the concept or context of what
And again, Your Honor, the answer to that lies in the Asperger's syndrome, because there is this need to if you've done something that offended somebody, you've got to apologize. You must be wrong, because if they say it was this other way, then they must be right, I must be wrong. There's this great need to please other folks. That's part of Asperger's. So the court put a good deal of its emphasis in its decision-making on just what you just brought out, these post-event responses and emails and such. All of those are perfectly consistent with somebody who has Asperger's simply trying to reconcile in their own mind and please the person that they've done. This is a case where even if you don't have Asperger's, all of the things that occurred in this should set up somebody, any rational trier of fact, it seems to me, should see that each of the things that precede this would suggest that this was to be a consensual liaison, sexual liaison. They meet They meet at a Barnes & Noble. She invites him to her apartment. Once they come to the apartment, well, I should back up, within 24 hours of them going to her apartment, she has sent him an erotic story that she has authored about a girl sold into sex slavery. She has sent to him a complaint about her current boyfriend's lack of sexual appetite. She has sent to him an announcement that she is a submissive, a sub, and likes to be dominated. They get to the apartment on her invitation. While she has a sofa from which they can watch TV, she puts onto the TV something that has a sexual connotation, and then she lays a blanket out on the floor for them to lay on. She enjoys him and says she knew he had a romantic interest in her. She found that flattering. She says that in the course of all of this, she knew he was a handsome guy, thought he was a handsome guy. He's massaging her feet. She has no problem with that because she says she has male friends. And them touching her doesn't. She's announced she's a sub. A submissive wants to be dominated. So to say, well, he puts her up against the wall and kisses her, that's consistent with what she has announced her preference to be. And this no, and the transcript does not convey inflections. When Mr. Harrison is testifying,
but she did say that she didn't want to resist violently because that would possibly trigger retaliation, etc. So, I mean, you're right that the transcript doesn't reflect the inflections, but her testimony conveyed the fact that her resistance was mild, shall we say?
And it's, you know, I don't know if this court had ever saw the movie Little Big Man, but there's it's a Dustin Hoffman movie about the only survivor of Custer's Last Stand. And in it, he is taken in when he's a youth by a minister and his wife, Ms. Pendrake. And at a point in time where he goes to an apothecary with her, turns out she's a floozy. He realizes he is alone and sneaks downstairs, and she's having an affair with the owner of the apothecary, and she's going, oh, help me, save me, oh, you beast. And she is, no. And that is exactly what, and his response to that was, she was yelling for help, but I really didn't think she wanted to be saved. That was in the movie line. That's exactly what we have here. She's going, oh, no. And Mr. Harrison's testimony was, that is exactly how she behaved in high school.
Don't protest too much.
That's correct. And his frame of reference was, that's how she was when they had sexual relations in high school. And that is how he perceived what was occurring.
I thought they said that the relations that they had in high school never reached the point of full consummation.
I think that was her testimony. I think he probably saw it differently than that. But in any event, his answers were that is how she behaved, how she acted when they were in high school.
One could suggest that when, as the... I guess the dominant, is that the term? Submissive.
Yes,
when the dominant partakes in this situation, that he or she accepts the risks associated with no actually meaning no.
And I have to say that is what the trial judge ultimately said was, well, you take your chances in this situation. But that is not it seems to me, a fair approach for a trier fact to take. In this situation, she makes no complaint to the authorities. In fact, when she is interviewed by the detective, when something comes up about a threat, and again, an Asperger's situation months later, when Drew Harrison makes a written statement that his therapist thought this could be suggesting he's going to act out in some act of danger, he contacts both the police and the complainant in this case. And she says there was some sexual assault some months ago, and he said, well, why didn't you report that? And she said, because this is what she said, and this is in evidence, said to the therapist, because when I told him to stop, he stopped. That was her her answer to the detective, she never makes a complaint. She tells the detective, when the detective comes to talk to her, the detective's testimony at trial was she never said that there was any kind of unconsented to sex. She never said there was a sexual assault. This is after she's been alerted that there's this statement made by Mr. Harrison, or at least typed out by Mr. Harrison, that was a concern. So we have all of that is in evidence. And for a trier of fact to say, there's no reasonable doubt here. She certainly was not consenting, because I can ignore all of these build-up that she sends to him to alert him what her interest is in her invitation to him to come there, her denial to the detective, or her no mention.
She, at trial, she did have an explanation, for example, by saying, well, she felt sorry for him, and that's why she had him over. So there's two narratives going on. I mean, there's the one by the defense that you ably presented about this tease that's going on and you know, kind of reeling him in. And then there's her explanation, which was, well, yeah, but we're just friends going back to fourth grade, and I had him over just as a friend and so on.
My response to that is, then you've got to look to what did she tell the court. She knows that this showing of sexually explicit photographs of her to him causes him to become aroused. She knows that. He has asked her not to do that, and she acknowledges he has asked her not to do that. And she denies to the court that she did this on that occasion. But she had acknowledged to the detective, when the detective talked to her a much earlier date, closer to the event, that she had done exactly that. So, again, it seems to me this is a case where a trier of fact could not conclude that there's no reasonable doubt as to whether this was a consensual act.
Wouldn't we, in effect, if we did that, accepting your theory, be substituting our evaluation of the evidence for the trial judges?
I think you can take the totality of the evidence that's in this record and come to a conclusion that there is not that there is a reasonable doubt. And I think you can come to that entirely on the evidence that's before you, and that any rational trier of fact would have had to conclude that there was a reasonable doubt in this case as to the issue of consent. And I think this court has the authority to do that. I think it certainly can do that. And in this case, I urge it should do that.
Yes, sir.
If I can move to my... I didn't mean to interrupt you if you have another question.
You have like 25 seconds before you get into rebuttal time. I'm just letting you know so you can answer.
I'll do quickly. The due process issue, this is a situation in which the evidence was that the prosecutor had acknowledged that there was a need for a treatment. The choice had to be made by the family whether to spend their money to have electronic devices downloaded and try to get the information that had been deleted within 30 to 60 days. They were told by the prosecutor on a representation that if they got treatment, that she was going to null pros the cases. This is at general district court level. It is not a plea agreement. It is a representation.
Were you trial counsel?
I was. Okay. No, I was trial counsel.
Okay.
I was not counsel at the time that occurred.
Okay. Isn't it traditional? I'm just asking this question generally. Isn't it traditional that if you get an arrangement, a negotiated arrangement, as arguably favorable as this one would be, where you're essentially getting rid of a rape charge in exchange for getting treatment, that this is something that would be reduced to writing so that there would be some basis as opposed to people coming in saying, well, I thought this, I thought that, wouldn't that have been better?
Not when it happens at preliminary hearing level. Frequently we have agreements in which the Commonwealth says, okay, if you waive preliminary hearing, for instance, when we get upstairs, we're going to go to first offender, and you will just plead, we'll do first offender. We say, fine, thank you. There's no written agreement to that.
A letter of confirmation, dear Mr. Prosecutor, this is...
I don't, but I've always had great faith in the prosecutors that I deal with, that they're not going to renege on something they have represented to them. Normally, they make a note in their file. I'm satisfied with that. Is that the best practices? Probably so. But is it a common practice? I don't think that in the criminal defense and prosecution side of our jurisprudence, letters of confirmation are not nearly as common as they are in the civil side. That's been my experience. Can I save my 35 seconds for rebuttal?
You have every bit of it.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court. I don't really have a whole lot to say beyond what I said on brief. It seems to me that most of what counsel said today are perfectly reasonable arguments if we were at trial. We're on appeal, and as Judge Alston's indicated, the main issue of trial was one of credibility, which the judge, both at trial and at the post-trial hearing, explicitly resolved in favor of the victim. There's certainly...
And the Asperger's is just part of that, from your perspective?
Well, when you say part of that, Your Honor, this came up before the evidence was put on, and counsel said quite correctly, we're not saying that this is a legal defense, and we're not saying diminished capacity is a defense in Virginia, and under the Stamper case of the Supreme Court of Virginia, that's clearly correct. You're either sane or you're insane. It might be perfectly relevant to mitigation for sentence. It's certainly not a defense at trial in the guilt phase, and counsel acknowledged as much, and I think, again, under Stamper, correctly. He also, it's axiomatic, you can't rise above your own evidence.
Counsel, that was an interesting response, and I want to throw this out to you. It seems to me, from looking at the sentence in this case, and I believe it was some permutation of 25 years with 23 suspended, that the trial judge in the sentencing aspect of the case almost developed some sort of gradation of offense approach. That's sort of the reading that I got. Right or wrong, that's the sort of reading that I got. And since we don't have gradation of offense when it comes to rape, either it is or it isn't, might that suggest that there was at least some concern or some question as to whether or not this was a criminal offense as opposed to a misunderstanding?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, he got a total of 50 years. Now, 47 was suspended, but 50 years is 50 years. That's a whole lot of time.
It's not as much time as if you have to go to...
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, it's sort of as a practical matter, sort of a mixed bag, but 50 years, nevertheless, is 50 years. I think it goes to show that certainly he wasn't a stranger. She'd known him since the fourth grade. And by the way, Your Honor had mentioned this, there's no evidence that I recall on the record that they ever had a sexual act in high school. She said that they didn't. I don't think he said to the contrary. But let me get, again, on this point that you can't rise above your own evidence. This is the defendant's own testimony at trial. This is at the bottom of page 226, top of page 227, which belies this notion about, well, if you got an Asperger's, you miss those social cues, you don't read the body language correctly. And the victim's testimony wasn't that she had these subtle indications of, I don't really want to do this. She was saying, no, 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 don't do this. I've got a boyfriend. Don't do this. She was kicking at him. She bit his lip. His own testimony, bottom of page 226, quote, excuse me, at any time if she'd said to me, even with the discussion we've had about Asperger's, if someone says to me, what are you doing? Stop. I don't want to do this. Stop. That's clear. I can clearly understand that. But Jill didn't do that at all, referring to the victim. According to her testimony, she did. So if you credit her testimony, then this Asperger's just flies out the window, because by his own testimony, that was sufficient for him to know that he shouldn't go forward. Also, that was pointed out by the judge in finding him guilty. And another important statement of his, the defendant's own testimony, when he was asked at the bottom of page 240 on cross, you never check with her to make sure that that's what she wanted answered. I could. I never said to her, I know Jill. If I had said something to her, that would have caused her maybe to back down from what she was doing. So in other words, he resolved any doubt in favor of going forward. The argument here in large measure is that no, in this case, meant yes. That may or may not be any more a viable claim at trial. It's certainly not on appeal. If she said, as she clearly did, that this was against her wishes, but she communicated that clearly by word and deed. Well, perhaps he, as the judge alluded to...
I mean, there's a context. In other words, if you just go to a friend's house and she says no and is fighting and biting, that's one thing. But if you have this background to it, I mean, to what extent should that change the answer? Because this is not your typical... case.
Well, I would fundamentally, my answer is that's for the trier of fact, in this case, the judge, to resolve. He was aware of all these things. He resolved it expressly in favor of the victim. It's axiomatic on appeal that a finding of fact is enforceable if it finds fair support in the record. If you read her testimony, there's not just fair support in the record, there's overwhelming support. And his own statements, I think, refute any notion that Asperger somehow gets him off the hook in the guilt phase. There was a statement that his...
I don't think Mr. Cooley's argument was that Asperger gets him off the hook. I think his argument was that Asperger provides context for the circumstance.
Well, let me put it this way. I think it provides insufficient context to hold on appeal the evidence failed as a matter of law. He said in argument today, the victim was aware of the defendant's affectations. I'm not sure what affectations means, but she certainly wasn't aware at the time that he had Asperger's because he'd never been diagnosed at the time. He, according to the record, he had been seen by a number of mental health experts. None of them had ever diagnosed him with this. This Dr. Dameron, who testified for the defense, said that at least initially when he met with him, he had not diagnosed him as having Asperger's. There's no indication that this victim knew a thing about that one way or the other when this crime occurred in March, or these crimes occurred in March of 2012. So her alleged knowledge, I think, is non-existent. So, again, I think her testimony, it was expressly credited by the trier of fact, both at trial and at the post-trial hearing. I think that there's plenty of evidence to support that. The counsel's reference, which I think he made at trial as well, to little big man, again, I take that in plain English to mean that no, no, no can mean yes, yes, yes. Assuming there are any legs to that argument, that's only on the trial level, not at appeal. Just briefly on this other issue, the due process claim.
Let me, before you move on, sir, I appreciate your patience here. One of the cases that was cited is the one of the Davis cases, and I'm going to read the quote from it, and I'll read it slow so you can have a chance to digest it. It says, the degree of resistance by the victim and consequently the degree of force required to overcome her will necessarily depend on the circumstances of each case, taking into consideration the relative physical condition of the participants and the degree of force manifested. If we were to take that statement in a vacuum, what would be your response to Mr. Cooley's position that that premise, that legal premise that's been articulated by that case, would be enough to justify us doing something quite unusual, and that is overturning a rape conviction on a consent case?
I'll put it this way, Your Honor. According to her testimony, which was credited by the trier of fact, when she came into the hallway, and by the way, she said she'd invited him over because she said she was packing, she was about to move, which he said she didn't say. So that's one thing right there. So, I think she said this is the first time she'd been alone with him. So they don't have some long sexual history together, either in the past or even more recently. At the moment that she's walking in the hallway, he sort of pushes against her, and she shrugs him off, and I think she says, "Nah, I don't really want to do that." Then she says, trying to get what basically had been this friend to cool it, she says, "I'm going to go into the bedroom to continue packing. You want?" And perhaps it was not the wisest thing. She said, "You want to come in?" But she said she's trying to get away from him. Once she's in the bedroom with him, she said that he pushed her down. He said that she put her hands up like this to help facilitate the taking off of her clothes. She directly contradicted that. She said that she kept saying, "No, no, no, I don't want to do this." She said she did kick at him with her feet. And as I think Judge McCullough's alluded to, she said she didn't push as violently as she could have because she's basically under the notion or the belief that if your resistance is going to be futile, don't make it worse. She said she did push at him. She bit his lip. And that is patently an issue for the trier of fact to resolve as to where does that leave you. And the trier of fact here expressly resolved it in favor of the victim. I think for purposes of appeal, that's sufficient. Just briefly on this due process claim, there were three separate grounds articulated by the court. The assignment of error certainly doesn't address all three, so we've argued that there's appellate default under another Davis case, habeas appeal, and also under, I think, Williams v. Commonwealth. Beyond that, the record supports that. The Commonwealth's attorney essentially said there was no agreement. She said, I practiced, I represented the Commonwealth in these sexual assault cases for 8 or 9 years. I routinely would discuss a possible settlement of the case with the victim. That hadn't happened here. At the hearing in January of 2013, when supposedly the parties had reached this agreement, she said she'd subpoenaed the victim, which she said she would never have done if there had been this agreement. The court denied this ground because there was no showing of prejudice, no showing through expert testimony or otherwise that helpful communications had been lost in this passage of time. I think the record supports that. So again, for both procedural and merits reasons, I think this claim fails. The Commonwealth's attorney said quite clearly she did not ever remember using the words "nol pros." She didn't think she did. It would not accord with her normal practice. She had not obtained any agreement here from the victim, which is something she would routinely have done. There was no agreement. So for those reasons and the others advanced on appeal or on brief, I think the due process claim fails. Again, I'd ask the court to affirm, and unless the court has any other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Very briefly.
The Attorney General comments that because she bit Mr. Harrison, that would suggest that it was not consensual. In the record, she says and acknowledges, and it's your Defense Exhibit 5 that's before you, she went on a website, OkCupid, and said that she enjoys rough and gentle sex equally, likes biting, and is attracted to dangerous situations. Post-event, she meets him again at a Barnes & Noble after all of this and recommends to him an erotic book that is her favorite. And finally, the last comment, at the proceeding, at the trial court, on the motion to set aside, the Commonwealth's attorney testified and said that she could not state under oath that she had not made the representation that was before the court and alleged by Mr. Harrison, by his counsel at the time, and by both parents had testified to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. We'll come down and greet counsel.